Good morning. May it please the court. Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, and counsel. The court has set this time for argument in the matter of Hogue versus Amex, and I represent Ralph Hogue, the appellant in the case. I think the issue is a fairly narrow one in this case. Mr. Hogue is not here looking to be excused for his failure to timely provide the defense with an answer to an interrogatory that had to do with a telephone number. We argue only before the court today that the remedy or sanction of dismissal of his action and therefore removing his right to appear before a jury and have his injuries and the coverage issues tried is too extreme a sanction. There have been, I think, about four or five cases cited to you, two of which are reported cases of this court, and they indicate therein that even when there has been a failure to provide discovery, the sanction of dismissal should only be applied when there's no other effective remedy to take care of any prejudice or address any prejudice to the defendant. There also has to be a finding that the conduct of the party who failed to comply with the discovery was willful. And if you look at the case law, and in particular, I've cited the Sundor case, which was Justice Duffy's case. In that case, even though there were some evasive answers filed, nonetheless, the court felt that dismissal was inappropriate. And in this case, I don't think we even rise to the level of evasiveness. Evasiveness seems to connote some attempt to mislead,
Given the history of this case, isn't it at least inferable that the failure to provide this discovery in the face of the court orders was willful?
An inference of willfulness could be drawn, Justice Jacobs, but keep in mind, if you will, and be mindful, if you will, of the fact that ultimately Mr. Hogue came to the realization that while he was searching through records and thinking back to the phone he would have used to make this call, he realized it had to have been his company phone. So Mr. Hogue never has had in his possession the records of these calls. And the argument, of course, is, well, yes, but if he had recalled that number or provided that information earlier, perhaps we could have gotten them from the employer. I realize that. But he always agreed to supply the records.
And is your argument, yes, the court was justified in drawing an inference of willfulness, but there was evidence to the contrary, and the court should have credited that? What I'm really asking is willfulness the issue here, or is it that the sanction is simply disproportionate, even if it was a willful violation?
I've undertaken to argue both, but you've stated my second point quite properly, and that is that assuming the court below was justified in declaring his conduct to be, or in inferring that his conduct was willful, to dismiss Mr. Hogue's action against the underinsured motorist carrier in this case was too extreme a remedy under the Delaware case law. The two cases that I have cited indicate, as I say, that where there are other sanctions that would protect the defendant and make things right, that's preferable to dismissal, which is obviously the most extreme remedy.
Now, the central issue in this case was whether your client was a member of the household.
That's correct, Justice Ridgely.
And how would this cell phone number or cell phone records demonstrate that one way or the other?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's tangential at best, I suggest. As I pointed out in my brief, there's an awful lot of evidence as to where he lived. But Mr. Hogue, whose deposition was never taken, incidentally, but he did state before suit was filed in a statement under oath in accordance with the terms of the insurance policy that he recalled calling his wife, Angela Hogue, once he had been stranded because his ride home broke down. Now, the judge basically ruled that the telephone number from which he placed that call and the records to show that it was made might be relevant to the issue of whether they were living together, if he called his wife to come get him. Okay, that's how it fits in.
Is it his position the call was completed?
No. No, the call, he had called earlier to say that he had a ride home. Back up for just one moment. Mr. Ho worked in Philadelphia at AC Reproductions. He usually took the train. His wife would drop him off on her way to New Jersey, where she was a licensed social worker, and he would take the train from Wilmington to Philadelphia. He would then take the train back from Philadelphia to Wilmington, and she would pick him up. He had arranged for a ride all the way from Philadelphia to home because they were stopping off at some function after work. So he called her to say, I won't need you to come to the train station. Her statement was taken under oath, and I've cited to some of that, where after she had heard from him that he wasn't going to need her to come up to Wilmington to pick him up, she went ahead, went to bed early, and does not have a telephone in her room and make sure that she doesn't, and never got any further calls.
Is there any indication in this record that the wife's phone records were obtained to see what calls had been received?
No. But what we do know is that at 5 a.m. the following morning, a message was left on Angela Hoag's answering machine. She got up at some point after that, realized that her husband was not there. There was a message, and it was from Christiana Care. So somewhere at about 5 a.m., about 6 hours after this accident, he had informed hospital personnel to call his wife at that number. She then responded to the hospital, went to the hospital in response to that call. So he called.
So if there's evidence in the record that the hospital called her at that number, why is it so critical to the defendant's case to find out that he called his wife at the time of the accident?
The only thing I can imagine, Your Honor, is, and this ties into sort of the second position that the defense took as these motions went on and the re-argument went on, and that is, well, I needed to test his credibility.
Well, that's in their brief. Right. On page 12.
Right.
Mr. Casarino said it wasn't an appropriate remedy simply not to let him say he made the phone call because the defense wanted to show that the plaintiff had fabricated that he'd made the phone call. So we have the case being dismissed because of a missing phone call that precluded the defense from challenging your client's credibility.
That's the way I see it. That's the argument I see being made, because I think the whole idea that, as you pointed out, this call in some way was important to the residency issue, which was the initial arguments, it just doesn't hold water when you look at the totality of the evidence.
Among the remedies that, let's assume that there is a willful failure and that inference is drawn, among the remedies short of dismissal, was one of them giving an adverse inference instruction to the jury that they may infer from the failure to produce this discovery information that the phone call that your client claims he made did not happen?
Before I came down, I wrote that down as a second possibility, because I think in my brief I simply argued that keeping him from testifying about the call would have been enough. But I suspect that without crossing the line into commenting on the credibility of a witness, which is what might be a little bit interesting, the court could, as it often does with respect to witnesses who just aren't called that would seem to have something to add, could instruct the jury about that inference. Or maybe stop short of that, but allow a statement to be made by defense counsel that Mr. Hoag says he made a call, but he hasn't been able to prove it, and he was in violation of court orders and failing to produce it. And then an instruction, I might have objected to it, but an instruction that the jury could then draw an inference about that call and whether it was made or not would certainly take care, it seems to me, of the credibility concerns that the defense has.
If we're dealing with business records or things like that. Let's assume they had been his actual phone records and he destroyed it, purposely destroyed it, an adverse inference instruction is an available remedy.
Of course. As I say, it occurred to me that that would have taken another step, been a second choice for the court to make if the judge below did not feel that just saying, I'm not going to let him talk about the call, was adequate. But either way, those were remedies that it appears to me, notwithstanding what counsel has said in the answering brief, that would have dealt with this particular transgression on the part of Mr. Hoag in providing this information too late.
But what alternatives to dismissal did you offer to the trial judge?
I believe the motion in limine was the only one that I offered. The instruction about an adverse inference didn't come to mind when I made my motion for re-argument.
In this case is Mr. Casarino trying to get the records for quite a bit of time, being thwarted or ignored on multiple occasions. The judge was asked to get involved, and the judge gave several deadlines and finally gave an ultimatum. And then when the records weren't produced, the judge said, that's it. I'm not going to waste my time, opposing counsel's time, or anybody else's time. You either get your act together or you had an opportunity to get your act together. Now your case is dismissed.
Precisely.
Now, is our standard of review abuse of discretion? And as I understand it, your argument is certainly there was a record to support a sanction, but no record to support the ultimate sanction of dismissal.
I think you've stated my position far better than I have, and that's absolutely right. There is no doubt that there was an order to produce. And incidentally, on the first one was for four pieces of information, as I recall, Paramore's name and address and a friend he stayed with and the numbers. By letter, those were provided before noon on the 16th of November of 2006, as required, but the phone number was wrong. It was the one he remembered, and apparently it was a New Jersey number that he'd had after this one, after or before. So it was not complete. We don't dispute that. It was inaccurate, let's put it that way. As I say, it then occurred to him, it had to be my work phone. He gave me the name of the person at AC Reproductions that I could call about it, Darlene Smith, whom I spoke with, and who agreed to make the record search, and the letter from her is in my appendix. At that point, of course, I notified the court and Mr. Casarino that I could not, that my client and I could not comply. We could not produce the actual record of the calls. And so that, willful or not, and I still maintain that this willfulness or evasiveness is a
Does the record show if there had been earlier action, when this record would still have been available? Did that precede Mr. Casarino's request or not?
Ms. Smith did not provide me with information as to when they had the flood that destroyed their records. And I don't know that. I can't answer that question.
I'd like you to clarify one aspect of your response to Justice Holland's question, and that is you agree, do you not, that our review standard is abuse of discretion?
Absolutely, it's a stringent standard, as it should be, because the judge below, of course, has the right and the duty to run her docket and deal with failures to comply with discovery. Unfortunately, failures to comply with discovery occur apparently all too frequently. But
let's just assume hypothetically that this particular piece of disputed information was relevant, although marginally relevant to the merits issues in the case. But that for whatever reason, including sheer cussedness, your client simply didn't want to produce them and evaded the court's orders intentionally. If those were the facts, would that record justify the sanction that was in fact imposed here?
In all honesty, objectively and as an advocate, I still believe that dismissal is too extreme, given the the nature of this piece of information.
Even if this was an intentional violation of the court's orders, the court would not have had the court would have abused its discretion by dismissing the claim.
Using your hypothetical,
right?
Yes.
Do you want to save the remainder of your time?
I would like to save my last 4 minutes, if the court please.
Very well. Casarino, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. And may it please the court, Judge Brady did not abuse her discretionary right to dismiss this case, and I submit she had no other choice, and there was no effective remedy in this case. The plaintiffs willfully refused to comply with several court orders. Mr. Hogue then gave false information. Mrs. Hogue never gave an explanation as to why her cell phone records were not produced. And Mr. Hogue's explanation, I submit, was unreasonable under the circumstances.
The reasons that she relied upon to dismiss the case?
I think that had something to do with it. The court wanted to know why this information wasn't produced and never got an explanation. The final explanation we had was, these are his cell phone records from his employer. Now, I notified them in February of 2007 from a letter when I subpoenaed the records from the phone number he gave me that it was an improper number. Yet they produced nothing from February until July when the court finally said I had enough. And then we get the, this is the cell phone number from his employer, not his own. I had requested this information, in 2003? And it was wasn't provided. You would think if he didn't have the phone number, he could have gotten it. He didn't give it to me in 2003, 2004, even though there were orders to produce it. 2005, I didn't get it. 2006, I didn't get it. All of this time, I'm asking for the records, and I never get any explanation from Mrs. Hogue as to why I'm not getting hers. And we get no answer from Mr. Hogue. And finally, we get the wrong phone number. It's a phone number that apparently doesn't exist with regard to Sprint, because I tried to subpoena the records. Now, this information was important to the defense, contrary to what the plaintiff says. It wasn't dealing with one phone number. Mr. Hogue said that his wife had called him four times that evening. This is before the accident, on her cell phone. And that Mrs. Hogue said that she didn't answer the phone, but there was one on her answering machine. There was a phone number on her answering machine or message on her answering machine. And she said subsequently that he had called her during the night saying that he was going to be late. These people didn't live together. I'm convinced they didn't live together. And it's a simple matter to get cell phone records. We do it all the time. Give me your phone number and the provider. That's all I want. I'll get the records. I'll subpoena them. Just give me the number.
All right. Would this conduct support an adverse inference instruction?
I think it's more than an adverse inference instruction. I think I wanted to show they were lying because that would dismiss the entire case once a jury found that out with the other evidence we had. But there was no request for an adverse inference instruction. The request was, just tell the jury that the phone calls didn't occur, which most certainly didn't help us. It most certainly could have.
You were the one asking for the sanction.
I was the one asking for the sanction. I asked for dismissal.
You asked for dismissal, but no one put before the trial judge the opportunity to impose a lesser sanction.
Mr. Carmine suggested that the court simply tell the jury that there were no phone calls made that evening or something along those lines, which didn't help me. That's no sanction. I want the jury to know that these people, because I was convinced, and I still am, were not living together at the time, and that this was a fabrication. And to show that, I wanted to have them testify, yes, there were these phone calls made, and I expected to have the records to show that these phone calls were not made. And
did we have an analysis that there's by the trial judge that there's no other effective remedy other than dismissal?
I don't know if the trial judge made that analysis. I think she agreed with our position that the cell phone records were important in this case, and that the plaintiff had to produce them in a timely manner, and then finally said, I think she was fed up in July and said, not only do you have to produce the cell phone numbers, but now I want you to actually get the records from the employer. And he didn't even do that.
Did you ask for attorney's fees for all of this wild goose chase?
It may have been in the motion, but I didn't push it. If I'm almost convinced I did not. I rarely do. So I doubt that I did.
Well, there are two issues that are implicated in this appeal, and could you help the court with both of them? One issue is when you're having trouble, like we had in this case, and as a general proposition, the court just says, you're wasting everyone's time, it's your case, it's dismissed if you're not going to cooperate. And then the other issue is the nature of the dispute. And if the evidence is critical and it really undermines your ability to defend, the court can say, we're going to dismiss. Or, as Justice Ridgely suggested, the court can say, we have these alternatives. We have other effective remedies, and we're going to choose one of those and move on with the case. How do they intersect or overlap? When can the court just say it's had enough, it doesn't matter whether the evidence is critical or not, it's dismissing the case because of the recalcitrance of the plaintiff to comply, as opposed to looking at the nature of the conduct and combining it with the evidence and saying, all right, in light of what's happening and the nature of this evidence, here's the remedy, or the only remedy is dismissal. How does that all get sorted out?
I believe in this particular case, Judge Brady looked at both. However, the motion went to the fact that we had asked for this information years before. I wrote 8 letters to Mr. Carmine to get this information. Mr. Carmine tells us at oral argument below that he had written monthly to his client to get this information and also to call him on the phone. It seems that, and there are 5 court orders requiring it to be produced. It seems to me that the court can say enough is enough right there. I mean, you cannot ignore these court orders, ignore the request for production for whatever reason, and just not give this information. But Judge Brady also said in this case that she felt the information was important to the defense to show that there was or could have been a fabrication here. And I don't think you need that second part, to be honest with you. It's not up to the plaintiff to determine how important this evidence is. I think it's up to the defendant who wants it. I know how important it is. I thought it was very important. I mean, Mr. Carmine's position is, well, this doesn't mean anything. But I think it did, and I think it's just disrespectful to the rules and disrespectful to court orders to say I'm not going to produce it, whether he thinks it's important or not. I think it was.
Well, let's assume hypothetically, and you know, you said on your brief on page 12 you wanted to challenge the credibility about the phone calls. In my hypothetical, the trial judge in this particular case says, Mr. Casarino, I'm not going to dismiss the case, but I think you've had enough and I've had enough and you're entitled to a remedy short of dismissal. What would you have requested the court to do? What kind of instruction to give the jury or what would have been helpful to you?
I don't know, short of telling the jury that these people were fabricating it. I guess the court could do that, although that may be a comment on the evidence. I'm not sure there was an effective other remedy in this case. But
so the court couldn't say, ladies and gentlemen, they contend they had this phone call exchange. They haven't produced the records, and I'm instructing you that the absence of the records can lead to legitimate inference that the exchange between them that's alleged to have occurred by them never took place.
The court could have done that. I can't say the court couldn't have. But is it an abuse of the judge's discretion to have not done that and dismissed the case? And I submit no. I think she has a discretionary right after five court orders and after 4 years, 3.5 years, to say the case is over. You're not going to produce this information. It's done. And that's really the issue. There's always alternatives. I have to agree with that.
Sure. So your argument's in the alternative, and that is sometimes, irrespective of the critical nature of the evidence, enough is enough, and it could result in a dismissal. That's this case. Alternatively, when you combine it with the nature of this evidence, which you say is important, it reinforces the idea that this was a proper exercise of discretion.
I think that's true. I would think my main argument is that enough is enough. I think that's where we have to go. There could be alternatives, but the alternative suggested by Mr. Carmack was not an alternative. I mean, that was the only one that was suggested.
Were the facts of this case sufficient to hold the plaintiff in contempt?
Yes. Yes, I would think so. I think if you don't comply with the court order, you most certainly can be held in contempt.
Well, Mr. Carmine's argument is that the underlying issue was whether Mr. Hogue was a member of the household,
right,
and that he had put some evidence to demonstrate he was a member of the household, notwithstanding your contention he wasn't, and that's why you wanted the phone records, but that given the evidence that he had put forward that indicated he might have been a member of the household, dismissal wasn't an appropriate sanction.
Now, we're talking about the evidence. There was he signed the lease. That doesn't mean he's a member of the household. And other than that, that's it. Now, he said that he made a phone call to his wife after he was injured at her home, and he said that's not in dispute. I don't know if that's in dispute or not, because I haven't seen his records either. I wanted her cell phone records as well when she was there. It's not in dispute that she went to the hospital, so apparently she was called by someone. I can't disagree with that. But there aren't a lot of facts that their word is what it is, by her saying this man was living with me at the time, even though we had separated before. That was it. And you couple that with, I put in there the medical record that showed she was extremely afraid of him. He had threatened to kill her and the dog, apparently. The fact that he said this happened 8 o'clock at night when it happened at midnight, the fact that the car was driving away from the home, not towards it. None of this makes any sense. The fact that we tried to get the phone number and the address of the alleged person he had been living with before and never got that until the last minute. We tried to get the information we needed to defend the case, and we're entitled to that. And when the other side refuses to give it to us and we ask for it repeatedly and try to get the court to intervene, and the court does, I submit that there has to be a sanction, and dismissal of the case is a good one, particularly if Mr. Carmine is writing to his client monthly and asking for this information and the man just doesn't want to produce it. It's not an abuse of discretion under the circumstances of this case, I submit to the court. Anything? I have nothing else to add unless the court has any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Carmine, you have 4 minutes. Do you have any reply?
I would like to address a couple of things that counsel said, if I may, please, the court.
Mr. Casarino stated, I believe, that somehow my client or I had made a determination that this phone number was not important. That is not the thrust of the argument. I don't want the court to misunderstand that. Whether the phone call was made, however, is de minimis in terms of the overall picture as to residents at the time, I submit. And I'm not going to go back through the litany that I've listed in my brief and in the appendix of evidence that Mr. Casarino sort of poo-poos as not important or not clear that he lived there. I think all the court has to do is say, why does a gentleman who was working in Philadelphia end up less than 2 miles from 27 Winding Road, Newark, Delaware, on this particular day, and heading south on 273 toward Old Baltimore Pike, and Winding Road is in a development right off of Baltimore Pike. And then why, when he comes to in the hospital, does he give them her number, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I just said I wouldn't go through it. But it is not that there was a decision that this phone number wasn't important. The fact is it wasn't produced. The fact that he failed to produce the records clearly, I think, has more of an impact, not with respect to the residence issue, but with respect to credibility. Well, something
Mr.
that the defense
Pecorino
is...
has referred to, I think it was five. Were there five orders to produce this?
I don't...
I'd like you to respond to his statement in response to my question that the overall conduct of your client was sufficient for him to be held in contempt for failure to abide by prior court orders. And if we reach that level, why isn't dismissal an appropriate remedy?
I believe the court has the power to hold in contempt anyone that violates an order. I mean, we boil it down to that level, and he is ordered to produce a phone number and he doesn't, then he has violated a court order. There was never an application in this case that conduct be held or found to be contemptuous. And had he, however, there might be an argument for that had he never at any time provided these records or given me the information as to where to find them. But he did. And what happened was that once that information was provided, it was too late to get the records. Under those circumstances, I don't think there is contemptuous behavior.
Well, how many orders does it take before you reach that someone does not comply with the discovery orders of the court that you could cross the line and can have your case dismissed?
I was trying to think about absolutes in connection with a case like this. How long does it have to be between the first request and dismissal? I think each case has to be just determined on its facts. I don't think you can say that once you have failed to provide accurate discovery twice, the case is over.
Well, how about five times?
Well, if it was five, and I'm not certain it was, I was trying to take a look at the docket entries.
Your opponent says four, it was five. You've been in this case from the beginning. Yeah. There shouldn't be any dispute about
well,
that.
Well, it's right. It's in the docket entries.
And so how many? There are five, right?
It was either four or five. I'll go with five because I can't point. I didn't count them before I came in. And there's, as I say, I'm not here to ask that this court excuse the conduct, but only examine the remedy. And it's being so extreme. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement and take a short recess.